You are listening to a podcast by the VIN News Service, an independent, advertising-free source for veterinary news. My name is Dr. Wendy Smith Wilson. Today, you'll hear reporter Lisa Wogan interviewing Dr. Brennan McKenzie. Since 2009, McKenzie has been writing the SkeptVet blog to promote science-based medical interventions for companion animals and discourage unproven approaches. He has become a go-to source for debunking misinformation and pseudoscience in veterinary medicine. His efforts earned McKenzie the 2022 Vin Veritas Award, which the Veterinary Information Network bestows on colleagues who demonstrate extraordinary courage and integrity in the service of science and truth. Nominations for the award are solicited from the veterinary community. A committee selects the honorees. VIN is an online community for the profession and parent of the VIN News Service. A condensed, edited version of this conversation, titled Veterinarian Lauded for His Skepticism, was published April 3rd.
Hello, Brennan. How are you?
I'm doing well.
So I'm just going to jump in with these questions. And so yeah, I'm going to start with the big one first, which is what is evidence-based veterinary medicine? Seems like all medicine should be evidence-based.
Sure. I mean, you're right. All medicine should be evidence-based. But the reality is it's not in the sense that we mean. Evidence-based medicine technically means that we integrate scientific research evidence into our clinical decision-making in an explicit and intentional way. So the three pillars of evidence-based medicine are scientific research evidence, the expertise and skills of the clinician, and the goals and values of the client. And those are the three things that all have to come together to take care of a patient. And I think, you know, we all make use of our own expertise and experience and knowledge all the time. And we most of the time take into account pretty seriously what the client wants and their perspective because they're driving the decision-making. And I think we tend to use scientific evidence in a sort of a haphazard background way, not in an explicit and intentional way. And what I mean by that is, you know, we have a whole base of knowledge, things we know about clinical diseases and about treatments, but we don't know where that knowledge came from. It's all floating around in there, left over from school or from books we've read or CE conferences or various sort of sources, but we don't really know what the provenance of the information is. And one problem with that is that we don't know how reliable that information is. Mm-hmm. Something that I do because I tried it once and it seemed like it worked to me at the time is fine, but it's a lot less reliable than something that was the outcome of a whole bunch of really good quality, high volume clinical studies, right? You know, there are different levels of evidence and some give us, you know, more accurate, more reliable information than others. So evidence-based medicine is encouraging clinicians to ask themselves, what information do I need to help this particular patient? And then to go and see what scientific information is out there that might be relevant to that question and ask themselves how reliable that information is. Does it even apply to my patient? You know, if there is a study with, you know, great evidence looking at an infectious disease in pigs, how useful is that for my treatment of a kitty cat? Maybe not that useful, right? So we have to think about the applicability. So there's plenty of room for individual judgment in taking the evidence and applying it to our patients, but we want to do it in a thoughtful and systematic way. And there are, of course, lots more details available. You know, there are training sessions for how to find evidence, how to appraise it critically, how to decide when it applies and when it doesn't. And, you know, most of us are just clinicians. We're not researchers or academics. So, you know, we have limited time and energy and training in this sort of thing. So usually for most of us, evidence-based medicine simply means making the best use of the resources that others have created and curated for us, things like clinical practice guidelines. When the ACVIM puts out a staging system for mitral valve disease in Cavalier King Charles Spaniels, that system is founded on the critical assessment of what evidence is already out there that other people have done for us. And that's a pretty reliable high level of evidence we can use to make sure that our own practice doesn't miss important things and that we're doing things in the best way that's supported by current evidence. Now, you can get as into this as you want. And I went off and did a master's degree in epidemiology so I can really understand how this works and how to do it. But that's not a realistic goal for most clinicians.
So when would a clinician sort of be inclined to stray outside of these kind of more verified, you know, the guidelines? Like, when would they maybe look for information outside of that or assist?
Well, the biggest problems that we have are excessive reliance on our own personal experience or on the anecdotes and experience of others. Mm-hmm. So a classic example is something like the use of metronidazole for acute idiopathic diarrhea in dogs. We've done that for decades on the basis of some very sort of loose theoretical reasoning for why it might be helpful. And then we've all done it a million times and most of those dogs get better. And so we all think that it works and it's safe. And we now have, you know, three or four good clinical research studies that show that for the most part, it's probably no better than placebo. The vast majority of acute idiopathic diarrhea cases get better all by themselves. And we just get the credit because we happen to give them something a few days before they got better. But it's very difficult for us to let go of that perception that this treatment works because we've done it and then seen an outcome. And we assume that what we've done is responsible for that outcome. So one of the ways that this works is simply we trust our own day-to-day experience as representative of causal relationships. And often it's really not representative of those relationships. And that goes for all kinds of medicine. You know that I talk a lot about alternative medicine. And part of the reason for that is that there are some special features to kind of the culture and the philosophical underpinnings of alternative medicine that encourage this problem. At least in conventional medicine and science-based medicine, we're taught that we should respect the scientific evidence and give it primacy over our personal experience. We still don't do it very well, but we understand the importance of that. But there is definitely a privileging of the individual personal experience of life and belief about the world in the philosophy and the culture of alternative medicine that makes it even harder to let go of practices that have been around for a long time that we've all done and feel like work for us, even when the scientific evidence is pretty clear that they don't.
Okay. So that's kind of one of my questions was kind of how did you become interested in sort of alternative and complementary medicine? And it sounds like because you sort of see this tendency in that area toward trusting your personal experience.
So, I mean, my journey in terms of science communication and advocacy started primarily with just being an ordinary clinician and wanting to help my clients. And so my job is to answer the questions my clients ask me, and ideally to give them the right answers, which means answers based on good scientific evidence where possible. And I began early in my career making handouts for clients and doing research on questions that I got all the time and that I only had kind of automatic, simplistic answers based on memorizing what I was supposed to memorize in school. And a lot of those were not alternative things at all. They were things like, should I spay or neuter my dog? Or is this vaccine safe and effective? Or what diet should I feed? And most of my early work was in those areas. And I started blogging largely because once I put the time and energy into researching these things and writing articles and things for my clients, I thought, well, why don't I just make this available to other people to help them with their practice? I think it became more about the alternative medicine movement because partly those were things that I hadn't already had a lot of answers to because they weren't discussed in depth in my training. And so I spent more time and energy researching them and trying to understand them on my own. And as I did so, I began to see that the problems with what we call epistemology or how we know what's true and what's not true were, I think, a little deeper in that element of veterinary medicine in that domain. And so there was maybe more of a need to talk to people about, hey, you know, science has some insight to give us on these practices, and it's often different from what you're hearing from people who are providing or marketing particular therapies or strategies.
Okay. Yeah, that's helpful. And I had noticed and mentioned this idea of your presentation where you talked about sort of getting through the latest age of endarkenment. And I thought that was a really interesting title. And I just wondered what you meant by the latest age of endarkenment.
Right. Obviously, it's a reference to the Age of Enlightenment. And the Enlightenment was a philosophical movement in the 17th through the early 19th century. And it involved many, many areas, not just science, but politics and art and religion, lots of other things. But it was a necessary precursor to the ability of science to give us all of the improvements in human well-being that have occurred over the last couple of hundred years. Before science could work and give us these tools, we had to have some shift in our attitudes, right? We had to believe that human reason and empirical observation were effective ways of getting to the truth about nature. And in fact, that those were better tools than relying on old-fashioned texts or tradition or history or revelation or the things that we had primarily used. Instead of simply reading the same books that Galen wrote in ancient Rome, you know, for 1,000 years, we thought, let's take a look and try stuff out ourselves and see how it works in a systematic way. So we had to have that shift. We also had to have a shift in the idea that progress was possible, that we could make the world a better place. There was a pervasive idea, at least in Western culture, that the world was, you know, sort of degraded from a past golden age and that, you know, we didn't have any hope of making it better. We tended to focus on the next world, and that was really our emphasis. And the Enlightenment said, no, we can actually make life better for people, and that's a worthwhile goal. And the way to do it is reason and observation. So there was a cultural shift that enabled science to then institute this revolution in how we live our daily lives. And here we are, couple hundred years later, living longer and healthier and happier lives than any human beings ever. And there's always been resistance to some of these ideas. And that resistance tends to come and go in cycles or in waves. And for a variety of very complicated reasons, and I'm not a historian or sociologist, so my understanding of that is somewhat limited. But I believe since the mid-90s, we've really been in a period where we're seeing significant resistance to a lot of those Enlightenment ideals and to the notion that science gives us meaningful truth about nature and useful tools. And I think one of the early manifestations of that was the anti-vaccine movement, where we saw a significant decline in the use of vaccines for preventable diseases and an increase or resurgence in things like whooping cough and measles that we had largely defeated in the developed world. And, you know, my grandmother, who spent 18 months in a sanatorium with tuberculosis expecting to die because we didn't have antibiotics, and who wouldn't let her daughter go out and play in the summer because we didn't have polio vaccine and all of these things, would have just been mystified by the idea that you wouldn't grab onto these tools eagerly as soon as they were available. So I think one of the explanations for why we're in this period of kind of backing away from confidence in science and in the scientific approach has to do with sort of short cultural memory, that we've all grown so accustomed to these things that we've kind of forgotten how much benefit we've really derived from this approach to the world. There are lots of other potential explanations, and I think it's a complicated phenomenon. But my point in bringing it up is that it's about beliefs and attitudes as much as it is about, you know, the method itself or the actual tools that we have or the technologies we use. And I think as veterinarians, we're not primarily scientists or researchers, but we are scientifically literate and we work in a science-informed profession. And I think that gives us some responsibility to advocate for these ideas, to remind people of how valuable and important science is to the welfare of their pets, but also to participate in the larger cultural conversation about the role of science in our life today. And so my feeling is, you know, the age of Enlightenment is just a dramatic way of saying we're moving away from some of these Enlightenment values that made sort of the modern world possible. And that's something that we can maybe respond to and participate in to try to help bring us back to a more balanced view of the role of science in our day-to-day lives.
Okay. I love that explanation. I love that taking me back to the Age of Enlightenment. That's great. So I wonder if these kind of trends seem to have gotten, I mean, it seems like they've gotten worse during the pandemic or, you know, under the pressure of the pandemic. Is that what you've seen? And has that filtered into veterinary medicine?
I mean, I think the main thing that we saw with the pandemic, my feeling at the beginning of it all was, okay, here we go. This is an imminent, obvious threat to health and welfare. And we haven't had anything like this, you know, since AIDS. And we're going to see immediately how important it is that we pay attention to the scientific understanding, that we use the tools science provides us. And science came along and gave us, you know, these vaccines out of nowhere in record time that were quite effective. And I thought it was really going to change the dialogue in a positive way. And people were going to be reminded because of our short cultural memory of how important this was. And I think, in fact, what we saw was kind of the opposite. I mean, certainly the vast majority of people still went and had the vaccines and listened to the scientists, but there is a substantial minority, in some cases 40, 50% of people have significant doubt about the mainstream, well-supported scientific case for vaccinations and masking and things like that. And we're seeing resistance to this at the highest levels in government, and we're seeing policies in place that have quite literally led to millions of unnecessary deaths around the world. And you can compare different countries, not just in the United States, it's lots of places. You can compare different countries in terms of how effectively the population accepted the scientific approach and how well they got through and how many people died or didn't die. So I think the pandemic has made it worse in the sense that we can no longer think of this kind of anti-scientific thinking as a quaint bunch of people who think the earth is flat that we can safely ignore. I think this is a deep enough problem that it presents a real present danger to public health and well-being. And so in that sense, I think it has, if not made things worse, certainly made things much more visible. To the extent that it's affected veterinary medicine, I think we tend to always experience the trickle down from whatever's going on in human medicine. Most of the therapies we use, conventional and alternative, are in one way or another first instituted in human medicine and then brought over and adapted for us in some way. And most of the odd things and problems that we deal with, like the grain-free diet, which is just an extension of the gluten phobia in humans, and resistance to vaccine, which largely followed the anti-vaccine movement in children, I think that we're participating in the larger problem. I'm not sure that it's necessarily different from what's happening elsewhere in the culture. I think it's just part of the same experience.
Okay. When you talked about your decision to blog, to kind of spread, to share some of your research, you said to veterinarians, is that your main audience, or are you finding that pet owners are following you, and is that something you want to see? Or
yeah, absolutely. I mean, my approach has changed certainly over the years. I, like most authors, I cringe when I read stuff I wrote 4 or 5 years ago because I probably would have done it differently. And I've been blogging since 2009, so that's 15 years, something like that. It's been a long time. So certainly my approach has changed in a very variety of ways over that time. I initially wrote the handouts for clients, and so they were intended to be aimed at a general audience. And my first thought was veterinarians would find this useful in terms of helping them to educate their own clients. And over time, I've tried to sort of split audiences. Some posts are certainly more technical and more aimed at veterinarians and veterinary technicians. Others are aimed primarily at pet owners. I always try to make sure that the language is relatively accessible to people without a technical science education. And until recently, for about 5 years, I wrote a column for Veterinary Practice News on evidence-based medicine. And that was where I began to focus primarily on veterinary professionals. So there I could use all the technical terminology, and I could expect a certain foundational knowledge about, you know, epidemiology and science and evidence-based medicine. So the blog is more and more aimed at the general public. And I absolutely, the majority of the feedback that I get comes from pet owners, who are obviously much more numerous than veterinarians. Though I do get some from colleagues as well.
Okay. That's interesting. And I wondered if you feel like, and I don't know if you can speak to this because maybe you're not familiar enough with human medicine, but do you think that there's something about veterinary medicine, either in how it's regulated or how it evolved, that makes it particularly susceptible to pseudoscience? Or is it kind of the same or worse in human medicine as far as you can tell?
I think it's a little bit of both. So I do have some involvement in this on the human side. I've written occasionally for a blog called Science-Based Medicine, which is sort of the flagship for the fight against misinformation and pseudoscience in the human side. And I think that the general problems are similar. The kinds of things that we see people thinking or saying are very similar, and many of the same actors are involved. you know, some of the worst pseudoscience in veterinary medicine is promoted by people who are affiliated with Joseph Merkula, who's also a physician who does this sort of thing on the human side. So, you know, the same individuals are involved, and people who have an interest in alternative approaches in human medicine frequently then turn that to veterinary medicine. We do have a couple of unique features. One is that our evidence base is woefully lacking compared to that in human medicine. So there's often less good quality scientific evidence upon which to base our conclusions. That both makes it harder to disabuse people of misconceptions, but it also makes veterinarians, I think, a lot more comfortable with working on the basis of pretty limited and unreliable evidence. We rely on our personal experiences a lot more heavily because we have to, because no one is out there doing clinical studies in 10,000 dogs for 15 years to give us the right answer. And so I do think that makes us a little more friendly to the arguments that these therapies should be used on the basis of personal experience or history and anecdote, because we kind of have to do that a lot, whether we want to or not. So there is a little bit of extra vulnerability there because of the nature both of the evidence base and how we're used to practicing.
Okay, that's great. And I wondered if, you know, if there was like one product or idea that you could erase from veterinary medicine, what would it be?
It would be the idea that your personal observations of cause and effect relationships are reliable. In other words, if I can, the number one objection I get when I present a solid, robust, evidence-based case against anything, conventional or alternative, is, yeah, but I tried it and it worked. Right. And what people mean by that is one of the things we say often is something called the post hoc ergo propter hoc fallacy, which just means, you know, if one thing happens before a second thing, the first thing must absolutely be the cause for the second thing. You know, every time I wash my car, it rains, because clearly washing my car makes it rain. You know, in that example, we think that's ridiculous. But every time I give metronidazole and the diarrhea gets better, we think that means metronidazole made the diarrhea better. So it's the exact same problem in terms of assessing how the world works. And that is the number one reason why it's difficult to get people to change their minds and change their practices. Our brains are literally built around narratives, around storytelling, and around watching these cause-effect relationships. And those kinds of arguments and experiences are far more compelling than tables of statistical data. You know, we haven't evolved to find graphs and tables emotionally compelling, but we've certainly evolved to find stories emotionally compelling. Yeah. And so if I could in any way take something away, it would be this automatic confidence in those kinds of personal experiences, because that just is the biggest barrier we face to changing our minds about stuff.
Okay. I wondered about the poor pet owner who is not trained in all of these things and, you know, finds themselves kind of bombarded with pseudoscience or sort of compelling stories. You know, what are they to do? Are they just to, like, you know, and since you're saying veterinarians are also sometimes, you know, not making the best selection on the science, what's a pet owner to do? How are they going to know that they're getting the best evidence-based?
Yeah, and I think we have an interesting problem here, because I think we all accept that the paternalistic medical model where, you know, you shut up and do what the doctor tells you is not an appropriate model and is subject to all kinds of abuse, particularly because doctors are working with exactly the same kind of brain you have and are subject to many of the same errors. Being well-educated and experienced and well-intentioned doesn't immunize us against these things. I often tell the story about when I was in my 30s, and I have a long history in my family of cardiovascular disease, and it was at a point where statins weren't being used for primary prevention. They were mostly being used in people who'd already had heart attacks. But I thought there was some evidence that it might be helpful for me. So I went to my doctor. I said, can I try this? And he said, sure. And I tried it. And I found I was having a lot of muscle pain and aches and some of the things that they talk about as being a side effect of this medication. So I tried a bunch of different doses and drugs. And finally, I just said, look, it's not worth it. I don't want to feel crappy just to live longer, so I'm not going to take it. 10, 15 years go by, I get older, my risk factors change, and the doctor is like, you probably should take it. We have much better evidence now. And two things had changed in that time. One is we had good clinical studies showing that all of these muscle aches and problems didn't actually show up in placebo-controlled studies. They only showed up in people who knew what they were taking.
Oh.
And the second thing was I took the drug and had absolutely none of those side effects. So what had happened was I had experienced what's called a nocebo effect, which is the opposite of the placebo. I was having negative experiences that I was attributing to the medication because I had an awareness of this as a problem. And I had plenty of other reasons for being sore. I was studying martial arts. I was doing all kinds of things. But I blamed the drug, right? And I do this for a living.
Yeah, right.
So none of us are individually immunized against these kind of problems. So we're asking a lot of people because we're asking them, on one hand, to be scientifically literate and to be thoughtful consumers of healthcare, right? We want you to ask questions. We want you to have informed consent. We want you to be in charge of your care and your pet's healthcare. But at the same time, we do want you to recognize that being an informed consumer is not the same thing as being a medical expert. There are things that you don't know. I go to my auto mechanic because there are things I don't know about my car, and I have to trust their expertise to some extent. So it's finding that balance. It's being able to recognize that you aren't just a blind follower of your veterinarian's advice, but you're also not equivalent to your veterinarian in terms of your understanding of these issues. And you have to take their advice pretty seriously. And I think, you know, the hope that I have for the future is actually coming from what I see in my daughter's education, because a lot of kids in the sort of more recent millennial and early Gen Z generations are getting a lot of education in school now about how to identify reliable information versus unreliable information online. Because that's a huge problem. We have all this information available that we never had before. And that's fantastic, right? I don't have to go to the library and ask the librarian to sort through the card catalog and find me a book on something when I can go and find all the scientific articles directly myself. But that doesn't mean I know how to interpret them or what they mean correctly. So I think that hopefully we will take this technology, which is relatively new, and we'll develop a more sophisticated way of using it so that we can be more thoughtful and informed consumers of information and recognize what we know and what we don't know and when we need to rely on experts and expertise. And I think we're in a transition period now where that's hard, especially for older people who maybe aren't as sophisticated in their use of that kind of information technology.
That's very hopeful to think that these younger generations will know how to wade through everything, because I think it's true that we've been at the leading edge of the onslaught and we didn't really know what to do. So that's great to hear.
I hope so. Yeah.
I wonder about your kind of switch to looking at canine aging and sort of why you have made that transition and sort of how are you dividing your thinking time and your research and writing time now between what you were writing about and canine aging. Is it always?
Yeah, so there are a couple of things. Yeah, there are a couple of things at play here. One is that I started the blog in 2009, and I've been writing about these things for a long time. And, you know, I'm easily bored, and my interest in things does wane over time. And when I've spent 15 years sort of developing my understanding of an area and having the same conversations repeatedly, you know, that becomes a little less satisfying. So in 2019, I published a book which was called Placebos for Pets, The Truth About Alternative Medicine in Animals. And it was essentially a summary of all that I had learned in general terms and also about specific alternative modalities or approaches. And for me, in some way, that was kind of a way of wrapping up that chapter and saying, okay, I've had my say. I've tried to give something to the profession that I hope will be useful in this area. I still talk about it and people still ask me about it, and that's fine. And I keep up with the literature, but I feel like it's time to pass the torch and, you know, I've done what I can do or what's necessary in that area. At the same time, I've been in clinical practice 23 years and I was getting a little bored with day-to-day clinical medicine, and the pandemic and some ownership changes had some impact on our practice that changed my practice environment in a way that made it a little less satisfying. And about that time, along comes Dr. Francis Chen, who was a PhD DVM at this company, Loyal, that I work for. And they were just as a biotech startup in the Bay Area, and they were beginning to work on developing medications to extend lifespan and delay age-associated disease in dogs. And she called me up initially to see if I would participate in one of their clinical studies. And I'm an associate, not an owner, and I couldn't make that happen at my practice. But I thought, wow, that sounds really cool. That sounds like the ultimate in preventative medicine, right? We're going to treat aging primarily before all the bad stuff happens, instead of playing whack-a-mole at the end where we wait for diseases to occur and then do the best we can with them. That sounds really interesting. What else can I do for you? And so I got hired as a consultant because they didn't have anybody at the time working for them who had direct clinical experience. They had mostly research veterinarians working for them. And it's useful for me to say to the researchers, yeah, you're not going to take a biopsy every time the dog comes in because nobody's going to let you do that. You know?
Right.
So they needed some of that pragmatic perspective. And for me, it was a whole new area of science to explore and to learn about, which was really satisfying. So for me, it was a combination of kind of wrapping up one chapter and career development and personal intellectual development in a new area.
Okay. Is there anything in canine aging that you've thought is applicable to human aging? Like, are you learning things that you think might help us?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, some interesting things about aging. One is that the core mechanisms, the cellular molecular mechanisms that underlie it, are highly conserved across mammalian species. So you find very similar pathways in rodents and in primates and in humans and in dogs and cats. It's a fundamental part of mammalian biology. So not surprisingly, it's very similar across different species. The other is that dogs, in many ways, are probably a better model for human aging than the rodents that we usually study, because for one thing, they share our environments. So they have very similar environmental exposure factors. They also have just a much more similar life cycle and a diurnal or circadian cycle. So in a lot of ways, they actually make a better model. And I think that the hope is that if we're able to find something that proves the concept that you can, in fact, use a medication to alter some of the fundamental mechanisms of aging and have a visible impact on lifespan or health, that opens the door to more investigation of that in a scientific way in the human field as well. Aging suffers from, you know, a particularly exaggerated form of the problem that all medicine suffers from, which is that it does attract people who want quick, dirty, profitable answers and aren't too concerned about scientific rigor, right? So there are lots and lots of supplements already available to make you live forever because there's very little regulatory requirement for scientific research to prove that they actually work. We're going through the pathway of FDA approval because that's the toughest pathway in scientific terms that you can follow. And if it works, then you really have good confidence in it. So yeah, I think it absolutely will be applicable. I'm a veterinarian, so when we get to that stage, I'm going to leave that to other people. But
right. You know, it's interesting. So you've gone and you're starting to focus on canine aging, but you find yourself facing some of the same themes and topics that you've already written about, which is, you know, the supplements industry, that sort of thing. So
yeah,
it's always coming for you.
Exactly. I mean, because all of the things that lead to pseudoscience and to misinformation they're not bugs, they're features. They're fundamental aspects of how human reasoning and the brain works. And so they're never going to not be present in any area like this.
Yeah, that's great. So then I just have a quick lightning round for you, just so I have this information, which is, where did you study veterinary medicine?
I graduated from the University of Pennsylvania in 2001.
Okay. And what kind of clinical work are you doing now? How often are you, in actual practice?
I do 2 days a week in clinical practice. I've been at the same small animal general practice. It'll be 19 years in October, so for a long time. And I went part-time when I started working for Loyal. So I'm 2 days a week in clinical practice and 3 days a week working for Loyal.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yeah.
And do you have any pets of your own?
I do. I have Brody, who's a 10-year-old mixed breed dog. I say mixed breed because he's so many things all muddled together that we couldn't even begin.
Perfect.
The genetics are like, yeah, 40% are these 12 things, and we don't even know what the other 60% is. And then Kalani, who is a nutball, she's a 14-month-old 60-pound dog who, when I looked at her, I said, oh, Labrador, maybe a little bit of herding dog, something like that. So her genetics come back 50% Golden Retriever and 50% Belgian Malinois.
Oh,
so
wow.
She's sweet and loving and has the energy of a nuclear reactor, never stops moving at all. So she has changed our life in all kinds of ways.
I was wondering how you find time to do all that you do, but now I'm even more curious because you have, this giant dog you got to deal with, so...
Oh, yeah, I got pets, and of course, I've got a marriage I'm trying to maintain in good health, and my daughter's off at college, but she still calls me up when she needs tech help mostly to figure out how to work her computer. And
what is she studying? I'm curious.
She is a history and Asian studies major.
Oh, neat. That's cool.
Yeah, someone asked her when she was 5 or 6, do you want to be a vet like your dad? And she said, no. And then she paused and said, I don't like all that body stuff.
Oh, yeah. I totally get it. That's great. Well, thank you. This has been so fascinating. You are such an easy interview. I really appreciate you taking the time. And congratulations on the Veritas Award.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by the VIN News Service, a division of the Veterinary Information Network, the world's leading online veterinary community. The story was reported by Lisa Wogan. Music was composed by Benjamin Olson. This recording is copyright VIN 2023.